of corn in 1944 than they had in 1939. These supplies weren't just for the American forces. The United States supplied Britain, France, the Soviet Union, China, and other allies. 15% of American output was shipped abroad. The federal budget grew at an astounding rate, from $9 billion in 1939 to $100 billion in 1945. Between 1941 and 1946, the federal government spent more than it had from 1789 to 1941. In 1939, less than 2% of American national output went to war. By 1944, 40% did. The GDP doubled, and the GNP rose from $91 billion to $166 billion, crushing doubts that the economy had reached its limit. Mobilization for war acted as a public works program, the largest ever. In Europe, even food was rationed during the war. In the United States, civilians enjoyed a wealth of consumer goods and increased buying power. The leanness of the Depression was over. "The pawnbroking business has fallen upon dark days," the Wall Street Journal observed in 1942. Even before the United States entered the war, FDR had claimed new powers for the office of the president. During the Civil War, Lincoln had invoked presidential war power, but Roosevelt claimed a range of emergency powers never heard of before. In July 1939, he'd placed the Secretaries of War and the Navy under his own authority as commander-in-chief, removing them from the military chain of authority. After Germany invaded Poland, he'd issued an executive order declaring a limited national emergency, a concept without precedent. Senator Robert Taft described the president as a complete one-man dictatorship. Within days of the attack on Pearl Harbor, Congress passed the War Powers Act, granting to the executive branch special powers to prosecute the war, including the power to surveil letters, telegraph messages, and radio broadcasts. Some of the new agencies created by the administration ultimately wielded little power. The War Production Board, created in January 1942, consisted chiefly of corporate executives doubtful about state planning. "The arsenal of democracy," I.F. Stone wrote, "is still being operated with one eye on the war and the other on the convenience of big business." Other wartime agencies had more authority. A second War Powers Act, passed in March of 1942, granted the president authority over special investigations and reports of census or statistical matters, and established the National War Labor Board and the Office of Price Administration, ceding considerable control over the economy to the federal government, and in particular to the executive branch. Just as the administrative state had grown in both size and power during the First World War, it grew during the Second. The Pentagon opened in March 1943, having been built in 16 months. The number of civil servants in the federal government grew from 950,000 in 1939 to 3.8 million in 1945. As federal spending skyrocketed, so did the national debt, which reached $258 billion in 1945, and called not only for war bonds, but for an unprecedented rise in taxes. New dealers sold tax hikes to the public as emergency measures, taxes to beat the Axis, while the Revenue Act of 1942, which included a steeply progressive income tax, vastly broadened the tax base. 85% of American families filed a return. Business grew, and so did labor. Membership in trade unions rose from 6.6 million in 1939 to 12.6 million in 1945. Science grew, too. The Manhattan Project, a secret federal project to develop an atomic bomb, begun in 1939, had, by the end of the war, employed 130,000 staff and cost $2 billion. The National Defense Research Committee, the NDRC, established by FDR in 1940, was headed by Vannevar Bush, the so-called Czar of Research, who by 1941 was also head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development. Before the end of the war, the NDRC employed some 2,000 scientists, including 3 out of 4 of the nation's physicists. Roosevelt liked to say that Dr. New Deal had been replaced with Dr. Win the War, but the war itself, by extending the powers of the federal government, extended the New Deal. The war also reshaped the role of the press. In the First World War, George Creel's government-run propaganda program had stirred up so much hysteria and hatred against Germany that Americans had taken to calling hamburgers Salisbury steaks. FDR, sharing Americans' bitter memories of earlier American wartime propaganda, had been reluctant to wield the power of the government to tell the American people what to think about the war. But the establishment of a government information agency had assumed a new urgency in 1940 after the publication of a book by Edmund Taylor, Paris's bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune. In The Strategy of Terror, Europe's Inner Front, Taylor reported firsthand on the campaign of propaganda waged by the Nazis in France to break the will of the French people and divide the population. "Words excite a strange tyranny over human affairs," Taylor wrote. He called propaganda the invisible front. 2 months before the attack on Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt issued an executive order establishing a new government information agency, the Office of Facts and Figures. To head it, he appointed Archibald MacLeish, a poet and writer whom he'd earlier named Librarian of Congress. The agency's mandate was not terribly clear. MacLeish said the executive order establishing it read like a pass to a ball game. MacLeish's ideas about how to write about war could hardly have been more different than Creel's. MacLeish had fought in World War I, after which he lived in Paris, where he wrote poems about places where lay, upon the darkening plain, the dead against the dead, and on the silent ground, the silent slain. After MacLeish returned to the United States from Paris, he'd been an editor for Fortune from 1929 to 1938, before serving as the Librarian of Congress. "Democracy is never a thing done," he said in 1939. "Democracy is always something that a nation must be doing." He believed that artists and writers have an obligation to fight a revolution created out of disorder by a terror of disorder, and that the real battle was the battle for public opinion. "The principal battleground of this war is not the South Pacific," he said. "It is not the Middle East. It's not England or Norway or the Russian steppes. It is American opinion." In directing the Office of Facts and Figures, MacLeish hoped not to produce propaganda, but instead to educate the public about the danger of it. One of his office's earliest pamphlets, Divide and Conquer, relied heavily on Taylor's book to explain to Americans how the Nazi strategy of terror had worked in France. To illustrate, it quoted Mein Kampf: "At the bottom of their hearts, the great masses of the people are more likely to be poisoned than to be consciously and deliberately bad," Hitler had written. "In the primitive simplicity of their minds, they are more easily victimized by a large than a small lie, since they sometimes tell petty lies themselves, but would be ashamed to tell big ones." MacLeish's pamphlet aimed to defeat Nazi propaganda. "The United States is now subject to a total barrage of the Nazi strategy of terror. Hitler thinks Americans are suckers. By the very vastness of his program of lies, he hopes to frighten us into believing that the Nazis are invincible." Dorothy Thompson, who once described Mein Kampf as 800 pages of Gothic script, pathetic gestures, inaccurate German, and unlimited self-satisfaction, had long been making the same argument. "The thing which we are all up against is propaganda," she said. "Sometimes I think that this age is going to be called the age of propaganda, an unprecedented rise of propaganda, propaganda as weapon, propaganda as technique, propaganda as a fine art, and propaganda as a form of government." The challenge to Western journalists, she said, was to represent a theory of journalism, a theory of what journalism stands for, a thesis of journalism, a philosophy of journalism, in countries where this philosophy is fundamentally repudiated. In the same spirit, MacLeish insisted that his office wouldn't take positions, but instead would give people the figures and facts. "The duty of government is to provide a basis for judgment, and when it goes beyond that, it goes beyond the prime scope of its duty." Journalists were doubtful. The New York Herald Tribune editorialized, "OFF is just going to superimpose its own well-organized facts upon the splendid confusion, interpret the interpreters, redigest those who now digest the digesters, explain with those who explain what the explainers of the explanations mean, and coordinate the coordinators of those appointed to coordinate the coordination of the coordinated." MacLeish clung to his idealism, which he grounded in the nation's founding truths and in its founding commitment to truth. In an April 1942 speech at the annual meeting of the Associated Press, against the Nazi strategy of terror, he proposed a new American strategy. "It is the strategy which is appropriate to our cause and to our purpose, the strategy of truth, the strategy which opposes to the frauds and the deceits by which our enemies have confused and conquered other peoples, the simple and clarifying truths by which a nation such as ours must guide itself." To deploy the strategy of truth, he called upon American journalists. "No country has ever had at its disposal greater resources with which to fight the warfare of opinion than the practice of the profession of journalism in this country has produced." Critics not unreasonably called MacLeish naive. War requires deceit. And FDR himself had little interest in what MacLeish proposed. Early on, Roosevelt ordered MacLeish to announce that gasoline would be rationed, when it was perfectly clear to Americans that there was no shortage of gasoline. Instead, there was a very concerning shortage of rubber. But the president, knowing that revealing the rubber shortage would undermine the war cause, refused to allow McLeish to reveal the truth. McLeish soldiered on, especially keen to use the Office of Facts and Figures to mark the occasion in 1941 of the 150th anniversary of the Bill of Rights. His surest vehicle was the radio. The radio division of the Office of Facts and Figures, headed by former CBS executive William Lewis, commissioned writer Norman Corwin to compose a radio play about the Bill of Rights. "We Hold These Truths," broadcast 8 days after the attack on Pearl Harbor, was the first radio drama broadcast on all four networks. Its stars included Jimmy Stewart, Rudy Valley, and Orson Welles, with music provided by the New York Philharmonic. "We Hold These Truths" was as much a call to arms as a celebration of the nation's founding creed, the original strategy of truth. The Congress of the 13 States, instructed by the people of the 13 States, threw up a bulwark, wrote a hope, and made a sign for posterity against the bigots, the fanatics, bullies, lynchers, race haters, the cruel men, the spiteful men, the sneaking men, the pessimists, the men who give up fights that have just begun. McLeish and Lewis then signed Corwin up to write a 13-week series called This Is War. Parts were hard-hitting, but as FDR's critics pointed out, much of it aimed to shore up support for the president. It compared him to Washington and Lincoln. Yet, in courting public opinion, Roosevelt found McLeish's Office of Facts and Figures too restrained, and in June of 1942, he replaced it with the Office of War Information, headed by former CBS reporter Elmer Davis, who was far more willing to use the methods of mass advertising than McLeish had been. A frustrated McLeish resigned and returned to the Library of Congress. Without McLeish as a force of resistance, the agency drifted, much of the staff at one point resigning in protest over the hiring of a former advertising manager for Coca-Cola. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Henry Pringle made a mock Office of War Information poster. "Step right up and get your four delicious freedoms," it read. "It's a refreshing war." Even as the war raged on unremittingly, Roosevelt looked ahead to the peace, concerned not to repeat the travesty of Woodrow Wilson, the Treaty of Versailles, and the League of Nations. To that end, he invited Churchill to spend Christmas 1941 at the White House. During the visit, Roosevelt came up with a name for their planned new international organization, United Nations. He hastened to the Prime Minister's room to get his agreement to it. Churchill had just emerged from a bath. Roosevelt entered his room and found him naked. "You see, Mr. President, I have nothing to hide from you," Churchill said calmly. Weeks later, on January 1st, 1942, the United States, Britain, China, and the Soviet Union, the Big Four, adopted a declaration by United Nations. The document was signed on January 2nd by 26 nations. All subscribed to the common program of purposes and principles of the Atlantic Charter and forswear the making of a separate peace. The Big Four also agreed to a military strategy, to concentrate on defeating Germany first by bombing Germany and then by landing in France. The Allied victory against a far more loosely Confederate Axis would depend on this unity of purpose. The State Department, meanwhile, formed a secret 15-person advisory committee on post-war foreign policy, headed by Undersecretary Sumner Welles. This study group devised much of the framework for the founding of the United Nations as an international organization. More publicly, Wendell Willkie dedicated himself to the work of convincing the Republican Party to abandon isolationism once and for all. "He who wins the war must maintain the peace," he said in February 1942, warning Republicans that to cede internationalism to the Democrats would destroy the GOP. That spring, he convinced the Republican National Committee to pass a resolution declaring that our nation has an obligation to assist in bringing about comity, cooperation, and understanding among nations. Roosevelt asked Willkie to undertake a world tour to publicize the idea of a United Nations. He left in August, flying in a bomber named the Gulliver. 49 days of travel included stops in Russia, the Middle East, and China. In a radio address that he gave when he got back, he called for an end to Western imperialism and the beginning of a new arrangement among nations. One World, the book he wrote about his trip and his vision, had hit every bestseller list in the country, becoming only the third book published in the United States to sell more than 1 million copies. Roosevelt called for a United Nations, but it was Willkie who raised public support for it. Roosevelt's Office of War Information asked Americans to understand the war as a struggle between democracy and dictatorship, between freedom and fascism. For most soldiers, this meant something less lofty. When reporters asked GIs what they were fighting for, They generally said that they were fighting for a home. Ernie Pyle, a reporter from Indiana, hauled his Underwood typewriter along as he followed American infantrymen fighting in Europe and Africa. "I love the infantry," Pyle said, "because they are the mud, rain, frost, and wind boys. And in the end, they are the guys that wars can't be won without." He wrote of the ordinary soldiers, the dog faces, and their bravery, and their misery, and the terribleness of their deaths. "Dead men had been coming down from the mountain all evening, lashed onto the backs of mules," he wrote from Italy, describing a soldier who stopped to sit by the body of a captain, holding the dead man's hand. Finally, he put the hand down, he reached up, and gently straightened the points of the captain's shirt collar, and then he sort of rearranged the tattered edges of his uniform around the wound. And then he got up and walked down the road in the moonlight, all alone. They fought in the mountains and on the seas. In 1942, much of the American fighting took place in the Pacific, where the Allies hoped to halt the Japanese advance. U.S. intelligence broke Japan's ciphers, and in the spring of 1942 defeated the Imperial Japanese Navy on the Hawaiian island of Midway. Allied troops then challenged and eventually defeated the Japanese at the Solomon Islands at the Battle of Guadalcanal. In Guadalcanal, Marines told reporter John Hersey that they were fighting for blueberry pie. "Home is where the good things are," Hersey wrote. "The generosity, the good pay, the comforts, the democracy, the pie." Meanwhile, on the home front, the federal government had instituted a policy of imprisoning people of Japanese ancestry, including American citizens. As early as 1934, the State Department had reported to FDR on the possibility of sabotage by Japanese Americans. In 1939, the president had asked the FBI to compile a list of possible subversives, a list known as the ABC list because of its rating system. People on the list were labeled A, immediately dangerous, B, potentially dangerous, or C, a possible Japanese sympathizer. In the hours after receiving word of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the FBI began rounding up suspects. By nightfall, the Bureau had detained nearly 800 Japanese on the A-list. On February 19, 1942, another day that would live in infamy, Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, authorizing the Secretary of War to establish military zones. The U.S. Army issued Public Proclamation 1 in March, directing aliens to demarcated zones. Restrictions began with curfews and proceeded to relocation orders. Eventually, some 112,000 Japanese, a number that includes 79,000 U.S. citizens, were ordered from their homes and imprisoned in camps in Arizona, California, Oregon, and Washington. They packed what they could in duffel bags and stiff suitcases, their distress captured in pictures taken by photographers, including Dorothea Lange. Lange, who had been stricken by polio at the age of 7 and walked with a painful limp, had become famous for the achingly sympathetic photographs she'd taken for the Farm Security Administration during the Depression. "Cripples know about each other," she said of her ability to capture suffering on film. Lange disagreed with Roosevelt's executive order. "She thought we were entering a period of fascism," her assistant said, "and that she was viewing the end of democracy as we know it." Her photographs, commissioned by the War Relocation Authority for purposes of documentation, serve as testament to that objection. Lange's FSA photographs became iconic. Her WRA photographs were, for decades, locked in archives, hidden from view, many of them stamped, impounded. Appeals to the courts proved unavailing. Gordon Hirabayashi, an American citizen and a Quaker who was a senior at the University of Washington, refused to abide by the curfew. "I consider it my duty to maintain the democratic standards for which this nation lives," Hirabayashi said. He turned himself into the FBI, but sought a legal remedy, arguing that the executive order was unconstitutional because it discriminates against citizens of Japanese ancestry. In Hirabayashi versus the United States, the Supreme Court in 1943 upheld the constitutionality of a curfew, if narrowly. "Distinctions between citizens solely because of their ancestry are by their very nature odious to a free people whose institutions are founded upon the doctrine of equality," Chief Justice Harlan Stone said in the majority opinion. "But in time of war, such discriminations, which are relevant to measures for our national defense and for the successful prosecution of the war, were perfectly constitutional." Justice Frank Murphy, while concurring, nevertheless regretted the ruling, which, he said, goes to the very brink of constitutional power, and which he considered, whether constitutional or not, an American tragedy. To say that any group cannot be assimilated is to admit that the great American experiment has failed. The curfew and internment orders had deprived American citizens of their liberty because of their particular racial inheritance, and in this sense it bears a melancholy resemblance to the treatment accorded to members of the Jewish race in Germany and in other parts of Europe. Fred Toyu Saburo Korematsu, born in Oakland, California in 1919, had tried to enlist in 1940. A welder at a defense plant, he refused to obey the relocation order, choosing to stay with his girlfriend, an Italian-American. He'd undergone plastic surgery to disguise his appearance. He pretended to be Mexican, and eventually went into hiding. The ACLU took up his case, arguing that Executive Order 9066 was unconstitutional. In 1944, in Korematsu versus United States, the Supreme Court upheld the order in a 6-3 decision, relying on the opinion in Hirabayashi and emphasizing the danger posed to the United States by possible Japanese saboteurs who might aid a Japanese attack on the West Coast. Hoover appointee Justice Owen Roberts, in a strongly worded dissent, made a distinction between the two cases. "This is not a case of keeping people off the streets at night," he said. "It is the case of convicting a citizen as a punishment for not submitting to imprisonment in a concentration camp solely because of his ancestry, without evidence or inquiry concerning his loyalty." And yet the war cultivated new forms of resistance to the racial order, unprecedented and sustained militant action. In the First World War, W.E.B. Du Bois, at the behest of George Creel, had urged African Americans to set aside the fight against Jim Crow for the duration. Eminent black leaders did not make the same case during the Second World War, but instead put pressure on local and state institutions, and especially on the federal government, to dismantle segregation, as did men recruited to serve. "Every time I pick up the paper, some poor African American soldiers are getting shot, lynched, or hung and framed up," a man from the Bronx wrote to Roosevelt. "I'll be damned if you get me into your forces." The wartime economic boom that lifted so many Americans out of Depression-era poverty left African Americans out. In factories, their work was segregated and poorly paid. So, too, in the armed services. In the Army, African Americans served in segregated, non-combat units, where they reported to white officers and did menial work. In the Navy, they worked as cooks and stewards. They were forbidden from enlisting in the Air Force or Marine Corps. "The Negro soldier is separated from the white soldier as completely as possible," reported Henry Stimson, Secretary of War. The Crisis editorialized, "A Jim Crow army cannot fight for a free world." James Baldwin worked in a defense plant in New Jersey in 1943 when he was 19. "The treatment accorded the Negro during the Second World War marks for me a turning point in the Negro's relation to America," he later wrote. "A certain hope died. A certain respect for white Americans faded." Scattered sit-ins had started in 1939. A leading legal architect of the movement was Pauli Murray. Murray, born in Baltimore in 1910, had graduated from Hunter College in 1928 and then worked for the National Urban League and for the WPA. One of her white forebears had been a trustee of the University of North Carolina, which rejected her application for admission in 1938 on the basis of her race. At the time, Murray was in search of a doctor to prescribe testosterone. She saw herself as male. Her struggle with her doctors met with no success. To challenge UNC, she approached Thurgood Marshall, a young lawyer leading the NAACP's campaign against segregation. Marshall discouraged her. Murray had moved to New York, and Marshall thought that a non-resident test case would be weaker than a claim made by a resident. In 1940, Murray was arrested in Virginia for refusing to give up a seat on a bus. Inspired by Henry David Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, and having recently read a book called War Without Violence, A Study of Gandhi's Method and Its Accomplishments, Murray had decided to try to apply Mahatma Gandhi's practice of satyagraha, nonviolent direct action. The idea was to protest injustice without violence by waiting for one's political opponents to perform injustice by their own violent suppression of a peaceful protest. Murray's own inclination was clenched-fisted defiance of Jim Crow, but she forced herself to act instead with utmost courtesy. Murray next went to Howard University to study law, she said, with the single-minded intention of destroying Jim Crow. Instead of fighting for equal facilities, Murray argued for dismantling the 45-year-old Plessy altogether by fighting against separate facilities. During her years at Howard, a time when most male students were away fighting the war, Murray planned sit-ins in Washington, D.C. drugstores and cafeterias. Participants carried signs that read, "We die together. Why can't we eat together?" In May 1941, A. Philip Randolph, the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, called for a Negro March on Washington to be held that July. I suggest that 10,000 Negroes march on Washington, D.C., the capital of the nation, with the slogan, "We loyal Negro American citizens demand our right to work and fight for our country," Randolph wrote. By June, more than 100,000 protesters were expected to march. Eleanor Roosevelt, hoping to convince Randolph to call off the march, met with him in New York, along with Bayard Rustin, a young civil rights activist who had been helping to organize the event, and who would later go on to organize the 1963 March on Washington. Mrs. Roosevelt led off by saying that Mr. Randolph knew of her affection, of her efforts on behalf of Negroes, Rustin recalled, and that the president would be greatly embarrassed vis-à-vis our allies if, in the midst of our preparation for defense of freedom, this were to happen. Eleanor Roosevelt arranged for Randolph to meet with the president at the White House. The president, too, tried to dissuade him. "You know, Mr. Randolph, that if you bring 100,000 blacks into Washington, there's absolutely no place for them to eat," he said. "Furthermore, there's no place for them to sleep, and even more serious, there's no place in Washington where they can use toilet facilities." "That is not my fault, nor my problem," Randolph replied. "But you can issue an executive order before we get here, opening up the toilets, opening up the restaurants, and making it possible for us to sleep in hotels." In the end, FDR signed Executive Order 8802, prohibiting racial discrimination in defense industries, and Randolph agreed to call off the march. Protests continued. Two black army sergeants in Norfolk, Virginia, refused to give up their seats on a bus. They were beaten and thrown in jail. A black U.S. Army nurse did the same in Montgomery, Alabama. The police who beat her broke her nose. Martin Dies in the House Un-American Activities Committee blamed communists, charging that throughout the South today, subversive elements are attempting to convince the Negro that he should be placed on social equality with white people, that now is the time for him to assert his rights. In 1942, FBI head J. Edgar Hoover, keen to determine why particular Negroes or groups of Negroes or Negro organizations have evidence sentiments for other dark races, mainly Japanese, or by what forces they were influenced to adopt, in certain instances, un-American ideologies, conducted a nationwide investigation, including surveillance of hundreds of black lawyers, organizers, artists, and writers. It would result in a classified 730-page report called The Survey of Racial Conditions in the United States, codenamed RACON. Far from promoting remedies in the form of civil rights, RACON warned of dangerous political subversives, by which Hoover and the Bureau meant African-Americans working to dismantle Jim Crow. Hoover did not believe that the African-American struggle for civil rights had come out of black communities. Instead, he blamed the Communist Party, and he blamed the Axis. It is believed that Axis powers have endeavored to create racial agitation among American Negroes, which would cause disunity and would serve as a powerful weapon for adverse propaganda, the director wrote in a memo to FBI field agents. It is believed that the agitation has been incited among American Negroes by telling them that the present war is a race war and that they should not fight against the Japanese, who are also of the colored race. By no means was the struggle against segregation confined to the South. In Detroit, white people barricaded the streets when the first black families moved into a public housing project, the Sojourner Truth Homes, in February 1942. "We want white tenants in our white community," read one billboard. Tensions grew over the next year. In June 1943, more than 6,000 federal troops marched into Detroit to suppress the unrest. In New York that August, rumors that a white policeman had killed a black soldier led to riots that lasted 2 days, involved more than 3,000 people, led to 600 arrests, and left 6 people dead. "Don't you see, Mr. President," A. Philip Randolph wrote to Roosevelt, "this is not a repetition of anything that has happened before in the history of Negro-white relations." Roosevelt offered very little by way of reply. Polly Murray offered that summer a poem. "What do you get, black boy, when they knock you down in the gutter, and they kick your teeth out, and they broke your skull with clubs? What did the top man say, black boy? Mr. Roosevelt regrets." After graduating first in her class at Howard, Murray was rejected from a graduate program at Harvard Law School, which did not admit women. She went instead to the University of California, where she wrote a dissertation on the right to equal opportunity in employment. Beyond leading the effort to adapt the teachings of Gandhi to the civil rights movement, Murray would pioneer an interpretation of the 14th Amendment that insisted that it could be used to fight not only Jim Crow, discrimination by race, but also Jane Crow, discrimination by sex. FDR, confronted with a sustained and organized wartime campaign of sit-ins, protests, rallies, and boycotts, pledged to remedy one of the most galling forms of discrimination. Black soldiers living in Jim Crow states generally could not vote. Surely the signers of the Constitution did not intend a document which even in wartime would be construed to take away the franchise of any of those who are fighting to preserve the Constitution itself, the president said during a fireside chat in January 1944. But when proposed legislation guaranteeing soldiers the right to vote went to Congress, Southern Democrats balked. Much amended, the measure that became law left enforcement to the states. As the Pittsburgh Courier, a black newspaper, explained, that the new law answers the demand for a soldier vote law while guaranteeing that the Negro vote will be taken care of by election in precincts, counties, and other state units, and therefore is satisfactory to all except Negroes. The American debate about the incompatibility of democracy and racism reached a new audience in 1944 with the publication of An American Dilemma by a Swedish sociologist named Gunnar Myrdal, who had been commissioned by the Carnegie Corporation to study race. The American Dilemma, according to Myrdal, was the tension between, on the one hand, the American creed of human rights and personal liberty, on the other, racial injustice. The three great wars of this country have been fought for the ideals of liberty and equality, to which the nation was pledged, Myrdal wrote. Now America is again in a life-and-death struggle for liberty and equality, and the American Negro is again watching for signs of what war and victory will mean in terms of opportunity and rights for him in his native land. To the white Americans, too, the Negro problem has taken on a significance greater than it ever has had since the Civil War. As a national consensus emerged about the need for Americans to find common cause and put their ethnic differences behind them, Hollywood filmmakers developed a convention, later known as the Ethnic Platoon, about a motley group of American soldiers who form a band of brothers. Eric Johnston, who had been an advisor to FDR, became head of the Motion Picture Association of America. "We'll have no more Grapes of Wrath," he announced. "We'll have no more films that deal with the seamy side of American life. We'll have no more films that treat the banker as a villain." A government pamphlet titled A Manual for the Motion Picture Industry explained that wartime films ought to be sure to include all manner of ethnic Americans as the people, and that part of the fight in this war must be against any form of racial discrimination or religious intolerance. Lifeboat, based on a story by John Steinbeck, directed by Alfred Hitchcock and released in 1944, is the epitome of the genre. The military and civilian survivors of an attack by a German U-boat find themselves on a single lifeboat with the U-boat captain. Only by conquering their own differences can they rescue themselves from his machinations. The rich socialite falls in love with the working-class Irishman. The black steward saves everyone. Whatever the influence of Gunnar Myrdal or Hollywood filmmakers on the wartime struggle for civil rights, that struggle was led by black Americans, intellectuals, reporters, artists, and activists. To win a cheap military victory over the Axis and then continue the exploitation of subject peoples within the British Empire and the subordination of Negroes in the United States is to set the stage for the next world war, probably a war of color, the African-American sociologist Horace Caton wrote in The Nation in 1943. Somehow, through some mechanism, there must be achieved in America and in the world a moral order which will include the American Negro and all other oppressed peoples. The present war must be considered as one phase of a larger struggle to achieve this new moral order. Building that new order would be the work of the post-war world. It was possible to begin to imagine that world in 1943 because the tide of the war had turned. U.S. and Canadian forces pushed back Japanese advances in the Pacific. Hitler's planned assault on Soviet forces at Kursk ended in a German retreat. Britain bombed Hamburg. Allies invaded Italy. In July 1943, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, the Big Three, met in Tehran, chiefly to plan the campaign against Germany. They also touched on the question of post-war international cooperation. Roosevelt and Stalin twice met together privately. Roosevelt believed that he would get along better with Stalin in Churchill's absence, the U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union later said. Roosevelt told Stalin about the plan drafted by Sumner Wells for a United Nations organization comprising three parts, an assembly, with delegates from all nations, an executive committee of the Big Four, with six other regional delegates, and a security council of the four policemen who would have power to act with force to prevent aggression and secure the peace. The idea of a world's policeman dates to the First World War, but in 1943, during a birthday dinner for Winston Churchill, FDR called the Allied powers, the United States, Great Britain, Soviet Union, and China, to serve as the world's four policemen. The meetings in Tehran, lavish dinners hosted by each leader in turn, were plagued by mistrust, and on Stalin's part, duplicity. Churchill felt that Roosevelt had betrayed him by meeting with and repeatedly siding with Stalin. "There I sat, with the great Russian bear on one side of me, with paws outstretched," Churchill wrote. "And on the other side sat the great American buffalo." Stalin reveled in his ability to divide the two men. The big three agreed on a plan for attacking Germany, but the statement issued at the end of the Tehran conference made no reference to the United Nations. At home, Roosevelt's rhetoric took a turn toward what would become the UN's language of human rights. A fight for freedom became a fight for rights. In January 1944, in a message to Congress, Roosevelt announced his plan for a second Bill of Rights. The first Bill of Rights had guaranteed certain political rights. "But as our nation has grown in size and stature," Roosevelt explained, "these political rights proved inadequate to assure us equality in the pursuit of happiness." Declaring certain economic truths to be self-evident, his list of rights included the right to a useful and remunerative job, the right of every family to a decent home, the right to adequate medical care, and the right to a good education. Time declared, "Dr. Wynne the War has apparently called into consultation one Dr. Wynne New Rights." Wartime prosperity strengthened Roosevelt's hand in expanding the government's role and securing rights, and civil rights activists had demanded it. At the same time, liberals were losing political power, not gaining it, at least as measured by congressional elections. In 1942, Democrats lost 42 seats in the House and 8 in the Senate. They still held a majority of seats in both houses, but a far diminished one. In 1936, there were 242 more Democrats than Republicans in the House. In 1942, that majority had shrunk to 10. In 1938, Democrats held 60 more seats than Republicans in the Senate, a majority that by 1942 had shrunk to 21. By 1943, Congress had eliminated a great many New Deal relief programs, including the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Progress Administration, the National Youth Administration, and the Homeowners Loan Corporation. Other New Deal agencies were either dismantled or had their heads replaced with conservatives. I.F. Stone said that the New Deal was beginning to commit harakiri. In 1944, Archibald MacLeese gave voice to liberals' anticipation of a reactionary peace. Liberals meet in Washington these days, if they can endure to meet at all, to discuss the tragic outlook for all liberal proposals, the collapse of all liberal leadership, and the inevitable defeat of liberal aims. It is no longer feared as is assumed that the country is headed back to normalcy, that Harding is just around the corner. MacLeish was not far wrong. In 1945, Martin Dies reconvened his Un-American Activities Committee to investigate liberals suspected of being communists. Anticipating Joseph McCarthy, Dies warned of hundreds of left-wingers and radicals who do not believe in our system of free enterprise, and claimed that not less than 2,000 outright communists and party-liners were still holding jobs in the government in Washington. The objects of Dies's ire included Frances Perkins and even Eleanor Roosevelt herself. "The First Lady of the Land," Dies said, "has been one of the most valuable assets which the Trojan Horse Organization of the Communist Party have possessed." Liberalism survived. It remained the principal governing philosophy of the United States for decades, but it had been weakened. Socialism had been discredited, and conservatism, while still a hushed chorus of voices in a wilderness, gained strength in the form of a critique of statism. In 1941, James Burnham, a former liberal, published The Managerial Revolution, in which he argued that the nations that had descended into totalitarianism were those in which the greatest managerial power was held by the state. Practically, this kind of argument had the effect of galvanizing opposition to the income tax. The American Taxpayers Association, formerly the American Bankers League, argued for the repeal of the 16th Amendment, and failing that, for a constitutional amendment calling for a 25% tax cap, a proposal initially made by Robert B. Dresser. Dresser served on the boards of both the American Taxpayers Association and the Committee for Constitutional Government, a businessmen's group organized in 1937 to oppose Roosevelt's court-packing plan. The cap, introduced to Congress in 1938, died in committee, after which the two organizations began calling for a second constitutional convention. "Our present tax system is doing much to destroy the free enterprise system," a New York Times business reporter wrote in 1943, arguing that American taxpayers should be given reasonable assurance now that their incomes and inheritances will not be confiscated in a process of converting our private enterprise system into some form of state socialism. By 1944, after the Committee for Constitutional Government had distributed 82 million pieces of literature, half of the states required to call for a constitutional convention had voted in favor of Dresser's Amendment, even though an investigation directed by the Treasury Secretary reported that the measure would shift the burden of taxation from the wealthiest taxpayers to the poorest. Only the top 1% of taxpayers would have seen their taxes cut, which is why its critics called it the Millionaire's Amendment. By the end of the decade, only one lobbying group in the country was spending more than the Committee for Constitutional Government. Wright Patman, a congressional Democrat from Texas, called it the most sinister lobby in America. The Allies at last invaded France on June 6, 1944, D-Day, determined to liberate a devastated and terrorized Europe. "You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months," General Dwight D. Eisenhower said in a message broadcast to the Allied Expeditionary Forces. "The eyes of the world are upon you." 1 million men eventually participated in the invasion along a 50-mile stretch of the Normandy coast, the largest seaborne invasion in history. It began at 15 minutes past midnight when paratroopers from the 101st and 82nd Airborne Divisions fell from the sky, trying to drop behind enemy lines under cover of darkness. Infantrymen carrying heavy packs weighted with ammunition stormed 5 landmine beaches, wading through neck-high water under fierce gunfire. A fleet of bombers and fighter jets attacked from the sky. "I had never seen so many ships in my life," said paratrooper Jim Martin, a 22-year-old machinist from Dayton, Ohio, about flying over and looking down at more than 5,000 Allied naval vessels. "You could have walked across the English Channel. Not that you'd have had to walk on water. You could just step from ship to ship." Aided by the French resistance, the Allies defeated German forces and proceeded to push them from the west, while Soviet troops continued to assault them from the east, the plan agreed upon at Tehran the year before. In the Pacific, U.S. forces defeated the Japanese in the Battle of the Philippine Sea and began bombing the Japanese islands. As victory in Europe neared, delegates from what were now 44 Allied nations met in July 1944 in the White Mountains of New Hampshire at Bretton Woods to plan a post-war order that could avoid the fatal mistakes of the last peace. Columbia political science professor James T. Shotwell had been at Versailles in 1919 and, like many delegates, understood that the objective of the meeting at Bretton Woods was to learn the lesson of the decisions made there. "The magnitude of the Great Depression of 1930 was due to two things," Shotwell wrote, "the economic cost of the First World War and the acceptance of disastrous economic policies after it." Disavowing the economic nationalism that had followed the end of the First World War, the Bretton Woods Conference committed itself to open markets and free trade and to Keynesianism, founding the International Monetary Fund, which would establish a fixed rate of currency exchange. Keynes chaired the commission that established the International Bank, which eventually became known as the World Bank. Even as this order was being built, a conservative assault on it began. 2 months after Bretton Woods, Austrian-born political scientist Friedrich A. Hayek published an American edition of The Road to Serfdom, a work that established the fundamental framework of modern economic conservatism. Much of the argument Hayek made in The Road to Serfdom had been made much earlier by Herbert Hoover, in The Challenge to Liberty, 1934. The New Deal, Hoover wrote, amounted to the daily dictation by government in every town and village every day in the week of how men are to conduct their daily lives. Under that and like schemes, peoples and governments are blindly wounding, even destroying, those fundamental human liberties which have been the foundation and the inspiration of progress since the Middle Ages. To Hoover and to Hayek, it was as if time were running backwards, from freedom to serfdom. Hayek, who taught at the London School of Economics, had been a critic of Keynesian economics since the 1930s. "I wish I could make my progressive friends understand that democracy is possible only under capitalism, and that collectivist experiments lead inevitably to fascism of one sort or another," he'd written to Walter Lippmann in 1937. "When governments assume control over economic affairs," Hayek warned, "the people become slaves. What is called economic power, while it can be an instrument of coercion, is, in the hands of private individuals, never exclusive or complete power, never power over the whole life of a person. But centralized as an instrument of political power, it creates a degree of dependence scarcely distinguishable from slavery. Less important for what it said than for how many people read it, The Road to Serfdom, released in England in March 1944, was published in the United States the following September, though it appeared first as an article in the Saturday Evening Post, was subsequently abridged in Reader's Digest, and was adopted as a Book of the Month Club selection. Hayek's influence would begin to drive policy as early as 1947, when he and other economists met in Switzerland to talk about how to prevent Western democracies from falling into a new kind of serfdom. They drafted a statement of aims, declaring that over large stretches of the Earth's surface, the essential conditions of human dignity and freedom have already disappeared. Even that most precious possession of Western man, freedom of thought and expression, is threatened by the spread of creeds which, claiming the privilege of tolerance when in the position of a minority, seek only to establish a position of power in which they can suppress and obliterate all views but their own. Liberals, of course, feared totalitarianism, too. As the Allies marched across Europe, reports of the devastation they found, the ruined cities, the slaughtered peoples, haunted Americans. What had man wrought? Over the course of the war, many liberals, especially those who'd flirted with communism, had changed their minds about the kinds of reforms they'd urged in the 1930s. As Reinhold Niebuhr put it, "The rise of totalitarianism has prompted the democratic world to view all collectivist answers to our social problems with increased apprehension." Instead of arguing against monopolies and for the restraint of capitalism, many, especially after the war, abandoned their interest in economic reform and followed the lead of African Americans in a fight for rights, and especially for racial justice. Another fissure divided pre-war from post-war liberals. Instead of arguing for and running public arts programs, public schools, public libraries, and public-minded radio and television programs, liberal intellectuals grew suspicious of mass culture, and after the war, openly contemptuous of it. In the 1930s, it had been conservative intellectuals who were revolted by the masses. In the 1950s, it would be liberals, a trend that would only escalate over the following decades and reach a crisis by the end of the century. That crisis began with the death of Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt had grown haggard. At his inauguration in January 1945, he was wan and weak and could hardly stand. During his brief speech, his whole body shook, as if he'd been seized by a fever. There would be no rest. He had agreed to undertake a harrowing journey halfway around the world, in wartime, to a summit with Churchill and Stalin. 2 days after the inauguration, he boarded a train for an undisclosed location, his car outfitted with bulletproof windows and armor-plated siding. Disembarking from the train at Newport News, Virginia, he boarded the USS Quincy, a battleship specially equipped with ramps for his wheelchair, for an 11-day, 5,000-mile voyage to Malta. As the ship entered the harbor of the Mediterranean island, Roosevelt sat on deck, wearing a tweed cap and a brown coat, smiling while a band on the Orion, the British ship carrying Winston Churchill, played the Star-Spangled Banner. Returning the favor, the band on board the Quincy played God Save the King. From Malta, Roosevelt and Churchill were flown separately, each escorted by 6 fighter jets, on a 7-hour flight to Crimea on the Black Sea, to meet with Joseph Stalin at a lavish villa, Livadia Palace, the summer retreat of the last Tsar, in the seaside resort town of Yalta. Roosevelt and Churchill had gone to Stalin, and not he to them. It had been a terribly dangerous and long journey for the two friends, neither of whom was well, but especially for Roosevelt, who was dying. At the time the conference opened, Stalin enjoyed more support in the American press than he ever had before, or ever would after. He appeared on the cover of Time in a story celebrating the American allies' recent victories, as Joseph Stalin's army thundered into the Eastern Reich. A month later, Time's cover story, Ghosts on the Roof, commentary in the form of a strange fable written by senior writer Whitaker Chambers, fiercely denounced Stalin for devising an entirely new politics, international social revolution, by which he could blow up countries from within. It would later be suggested that Roosevelt, his powers diminished, had appeased Stalin at Yalta, with fateful consequences. As Stalin's ruthlessness later became altogether plain, it became clear, too, that the agreement reached at Yalta hadn't stopped Stalin from taking over Eastern Europe, and it may have made possible the communist takeover of China. Later, too, there would follow intimations of intrigue and even of treason, after it was revealed that Alger Hiss, an American delegate to the conference, was a Soviet spy. But Soviet archives, opened after the end of the Cold War, would reveal that he reported to the military, not to the political branch, and that his reports from Yalta had little or no effect on the proceedings. And by many measures, Roosevelt got from Stalin the most that it may have been possible for an American president to get. Churchill had brought with him his traveling map room, the British embassy having sent particular instructions. Mr. Churchill hopes that his map room may be adjacent to his private quarters at Yalta, and it should be so placed as to be accessible to President Roosevelt when wheeled in his chair. Roosevelt, following the principles of the Atlantic Charter, arrived at Yalta determined not to slice and dice Europe and handhold peoples over to imperial rule, as had been done at the end of the last war. He hoped to agree on a plan for how to win the war and to divide up Germany in a way that was agreeable to both Stalin and Churchill, in exchange for Stalin's agreement to enter the war with Japan. The conference opened in the palace's ballroom on February 4th. Churchill, who distrusted Stalin even more than Roosevelt did, repeatedly sought alliances with Roosevelt to no avail, since Roosevelt was chiefly occupied trying to convince Stalin to join the fight against Japan. Neither Roosevelt nor Churchill enjoyed a particularly strong bargaining position. Both needed help from the Red Army, Churchill in Europe and Roosevelt in the Pacific. To secure Stalin's support, Roosevelt betrayed the principles of the Atlantic Charter in granting to Stalin, even before the war was over, territories in China, at the time an American ally. In the end, the three men agreed to a division of Germany into zones of occupation and to the prosecution of Nazi war criminals. In 3 months, Germany would surrender. In 6 months, Japan. But before either of those nations surrendered, Stalin had already begun to betray the pledges he'd made at Yalta. On March 1st, Roosevelt reported to Congress on the Yalta Conference, describing the United Nations as a universal organization in which all peace-loving nations will finally have a chance to join. He'd grown even thinner and paler. He spoke from a chair, unable to stand and bear the weight of his metal braces. His hands trembled. He slurred his words. On April 12th, while sitting for a portrait at his retreat, the little White House in Warm Springs, Georgia, he collapsed. He died at 3:35 p.m. of a cerebral hemorrhage. His death was broadcast at 5:47 p.m. We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin from CBS World News. Stations across the country canceled their regular programming for days and played only news reports, the president's favorite music, and tributes. A stricken Harry S. Truman, who'd taken the oath of office 4 hours after Roosevelt's death, said the next day, "There have been few men in all history the equal of the man into whose shoes I am stepping." Archibald MacLeish, 3 minutes into an address to the country on CBS, fell apart, weeping, as he said the words, "Our great president, who is now so tragically dead at the moment of greatest need." Radio correspondents reported on the funeral train that carried the flag-draped coffin to Hyde Park, as solemn crowds gathered at every station along the way. CBS announcer Arthur Godfrey reported from Washington when Roosevelt's coffin was carried through the streets on a wagon led by 6 white horses, flanked by motorcycles, while a crowd, 20 people deep, watched from the sidewalk. "God give me the strength to do this," Godfrey said as he lost control of himself when the coffin passed. On April 15th, the day FDR was buried at his home in Hyde Park, CBS reporter Edward R. Murrow delivered on American radio the first eyewitness description of a Nazi concentration camp to reach the American public. At Buchenwald, he met the camp doctor. "We inspected his records," Murrow said, his deep voice deepening. "There were only 3 names in the little black book, nothing more, nothing about who these men were, what they had done or hoped. Behind these names of those who had died, there was a cross. I counted them. They totaled 242 out of 1,200 in 1 month. Month after month they had died, unnamed, slaughtered. No prayers at their graves." Murrow, born in Polecat Creek, North Carolina, had been hired by CBS in 1935 to run its London office and coordinate its European coverage. He'd never trained as a reporter. But by 1938, in the Anschluss, he'd been conscripted into the work of reporting on fast-breaking news from the field. His first words on the radio in what CBS decided to call a special report were, "This is Edward Murrow, speaking from Vienna. It's now nearly 3:30 in the morning, and Herr Hitler has not yet arrived." In 1940, during the Blitz, he'd reported from the rooftops of London, transmitting a sense of such immediacy and intensity that he'd helped turn the tide of American opinion in favor of entering the war. "You laid the dead of London at our doors," Archibald MacLeish told him, "and we knew that the dead were our dead." By the spring of 1945, Murrow was both a veteran of the new art and science, a foreign radio correspondent, and a voice known, heard, and trusted across the United States. On April 11th, soldiers from the U.S. 9th Armored Infantry Battalion had reached Buchenwald near Weimar. Soldiers from the 80th Infantry Division had arrived the next day, along with a group of reporters, including Murrow. In 1943, in a meeting at the Polish Embassy in Washington, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter had met Jan Karski, a Polish socialist who had escaped Bejuzet. In 1943, in a meeting at the Polish Embassy in Washington, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter had met Jan Karski, a Polish socialist who had escaped Bejuzet. Karski described the death camp. Frankfurter was unable to speak. A full 10 minutes elapsed. "I am unable to believe you," he said finally. "Felix, you cannot tell this man to his face that he is lying," said the Polish ambassador. "I said that I am unable to believe him," Frankfurter reported. "There is a difference." At Buchenwald on April 15, 1945, Murrow reported that he had asked to see one of the barracks. "It happened to be occupied by the Czechoslovaks," he said. "When I entered, men crowded around, tried to lift me to their shoulders. They were too weak. Many of them could not get out of bed." Murrow's voice tightened. "As we walked out into the courtyard, a man fell dead." Murrow did not use the word Jew at any point in his report, nor did most reporters. Life described the people confined at Dachau as the men of all nations that Hitler's agents had picked out as prime opponents of Nazism. Eisenhower visited Ardruf, a smaller camp outside Buchenwald, reporting to George C. Marshall on the same day that Murrow reported on live radio from Buchenwald. In one room, where there were piled up 20 or 30 naked men killed by starvation, George Patton would not even enter. He said he would get sick if he did so. "I made the visit deliberately in order to be in position to give first-hand evidence of these things, if ever, in the future, there develops a tendency to charge these allegations merely to propaganda." Despite these reports, the scale of Nazi atrocities remained all but unknown in the West. Only about a fifth of the prisoners at Buchenwald, Ardruf, and Dachau were in fact Jews. The rest were political prisoners and prisoners of war. The death camps, like Auschwitz, where nearly all the prisoners were Jews, had been closed before the Allies arrived, or else liberated by the Soviets. American reporters did not generally see them. The extent of the genocide, the murder of 6 million Jews, would not reach the American public for years to come. 3 days after Eisenhower stopped at Ardruf, the 305th Infantry invaded the island of Iwo Jima near Okinawa. Reporter Ernie Pyle was in a jeep that was driven into a ditch by machine gun fire. When Pyle raised his head to look around, he was shot in the temple, a hair's breadth under his helmet. He was 44. He died on April 18, 1945, with the dog faces he loved, and whose war he'd chronicled better than any other writer. At the time he was shot, he'd been writing a column. A draft was found in his rucksack. It began, "And so it is over." It wasn't quite over, but very nearly. On April 24th, Secretary of War Henry Stimson sent a memo to the fledgling President Truman, stamped, "Secret. I think it is very important that I should have a talk with you as soon as possible." Truman had been told about the existence of the atomic bomb within hours of his swearing-in, but Stimson wanted to tell him now that the weapon was almost ready. In Europe, the Allied forces closed in on the Axis. On April 25th, American forces fighting Germany from the west and Soviet forces driving from the east met on the Elbe River. Italian partisans caught up with Mussolini on April 28th, shot him down, and dumped his body on the street, where a mob urinated on it and hung him up by his heels. 2 days later, in a bunker in Berlin, Hitler committed suicide. Germany signed a total and unconditional surrender on May 7th. Stalin had already begun pressing his claims to influence over the territory Hitler had so brutally conquered. At Yalta, he'd promised to allow free and unfettered elections in Poland. By spring, he'd abandoned that pledge. On April 28th, Churchill, astutely perceiving what this foretold, wrote to Stalin, "There's not much comfort in looking to a future where you and the countries you dominate, plus the communist parties in other states, are all drawn up on one side, and those who rally to the English-speaking nations and their associates and dominions are on the other." There was little comfort in such a future, but it would come all the same. The world of tomorrow, imagined by the smooth-talking planners of the 1939 World's Fair, a world of Electro the Motoman and automatic dishwashing machines, would come too. Its chorus line of women, dressed in white, performing a pageant of peace, had been followed by 6 years of horrifying warfare and genocide, the shocking brutality of modernity. People living in different countries kill each other at irregular time intervals.